because there are a means God has appointed whereby people can be brought out of darkness and be rooted and grounded in love so that they can enjoy the blessedness of knowing the love of Christ that passes understanding. But it's first things first, is my point. God has appointed through the foolishness of preaching, not foolish preaching, but the foolishness of preaching to save those that will be saved. God has appointed His means by which sinners can end up knowing the height and breadth and length and depth, and to know the love of Christ, which passes knowledge. God has appointed means to that. But He is revealing to us what the sinner cannot know in a state of selfishness. And the imperative of first having a state of benevolence, having a character, a willingness to do the will of God in order to know whether the teaching is from God. That is a truth that I am trying to expose to us tonight, for us to examine, for us to see, and commit to see it so forcefully that we will alter the way we talk to other people, to alter the way we view our relationship with talking to other people about the truth, to alter the way we presuppose we will know the truth. First things first. Our character must come prior. Our rooted and grounded in love must come prior before we have these magnificent revelations of Jesus and all of His offices. A willingness to do His will must come first before you have a certainty that this teaching is from God. The typical apologetic ministry is not suited for people to know the love of God that passes knowledge. It starts off at the wrong end. It is trying to persuade people to believe that which they cannot believe until they have a change of heart. And they're trying to get them to believe it in order to have a change of heart. And Paul says, and Peter says, you can't see those things, you will never believe those things, you'll never see those things and understand those things until you have a change of heart. An apologetic ministry who tries to prove that the teaching is from God so that people will be willing to do His will, has got it backwards. And our thinking can be just as backwards through faulty thinking, faulty understanding, through the influence of those who would say, you must lay before them all of these truths and prove to them that this is the Bible, and then they'll be willing to do as well. Well, Greg shared his testimony with probably all of us at the time or two, where he became persuaded at some point in time that the Bible was true. He wasn't yet converted. He believed the Bible was true. He didn't believe that the teaching was true, because he is not yet willing to do His will through various reasons. I just point him out because that's just true of everybody who's gotten converted. Let's continue. I understand your review, Greg. I think I addressed it. Another loose end that may become apparent to some of you too. We'll come across it. 1 Timothy 2:4.1 Timothy 2:4. Teresa, would you read that, please?
He desires all men to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth.
He desires all men to be saved and to come to a knowledge of the truth. Why isn't it? He desires all men to come to a knowledge of the truth and be saved. Turn to Matthew chapter... Well, let's turn to Psalms 111. Psalms 111. Psalms 111, 10. Pat?
I just wanted to see if my understanding is right. People do have to come to a knowledge of something.
Yes, they do, and that's the other...
It's not like they get saved and don't know anything.
That's true, and that's the other loose end.
Oh.
And we're going to deal with that. We're just waiting for somebody to discover it. You can have no faith without truth. You can have no faith based upon a vacuum. There has to be some knowledge as an object of faith. But there is a class of truth that cannot be known except to those who are in a state of benevolence, who have a pure heart. Psalms 1, and we'll get there. Psalms 111, verse 10. Keith, would you read that?
And good understanding have all they that do his commandments. His praise and his praise.
The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, not the end of wisdom, the result of wisdom. A good understanding have all those who do his commandments. There is something that your children do not know about you, do not understand about right and wrong, do not understand about the blessedness of their own natures unless they obey you. When your children are willing to do your will, they begin to discover a knowledge about things that they will never learn while they remain disobedient to your will. They will begin to be taught through their own obedience about relationships, government, necessity of obedience, law, rule. They will never learn that until they are willing to do your will. When they are willing to do your will, then they really begin to learn some things. You will never learn any other way. I use that as a model to demonstrate that those who do his commandments have understanding. Those who love him, being rooted and grounded in love, have a knowledge that those who do not love him do not have. It's a different class of knowledge. Some people, you know, the old saying is, if I knew what you knew about Jesus, I would trust him too. No, 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 no. I know what I know about Jesus because I trust him. That's the fruit of trusting, not the cause of trusting. Psalm 73. Psalm 73. Verses 21 and 22. Paul, would you read that, please?
Thus my heart was grieved, and I was pricked in my reins. So foolish was I and ignorant. I was as a beast before thee.
Okay. I'd like that read again in the New American. Greg, would you read that? Do you have that? 21 and 22.
When my heart was embittered, and I was pierced within, then I was senseless and ignorant. I was like a beast before thee.
This picture is that the senselessness and ignorance was a result of a heart that was embittered and was pierced within. Turn to Psalms. Turn to Matthew chapter 13. Matthew chapter 13. Matthew chapter 13 is the parable of the sower and the seed and four kinds of soil. Okay? And Jesus gives the parable in verses 3 through 9. And he says there's four kinds of soil. And there was some who fell by the roads, and the birds came and ate them up. The seed fell upon rocky places, didn't have much soil. It sprang up, and the sun rose, and they were scorched, and they had no root, and they withered away. Others fell among thorns, and the thorns came up and choked them out. Others fell on the good soil and yielded a crop, some 100-fold, some 60, and some 30. And the disciple says, why do you speak to them in parables? Verse 10. So then he explains the parable down in verse 19. Let us read verse 19 through 23. We will go around, read one verse each as we go around, starting with Tim, then Paul, and read through the explanation of the parable. Tim?
When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and does not understand it, the evil one comes and snatches away what has been sown in his heart. This is the one on whom seed was sown beside the road.
But he that receives the seed in the stony places, the same as he that heareth the word, and anon with joy receiveth it.
Keith?
But hath he not rooted himself, but endureth for a while, for when tribulation or persecution arises because of the word, and by and by he is offended.
Craig?
And the one on whom seed was sown among the thorns, this is the man who hears the word, and the worry of the world, and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word, and it becomes unfruitful.
Ron?
And the one on whom seed was sown on the good ground, this is the man who hears the word and understands it, who indeed bears fruit and brings forth some 100-fold, some 60, and some 30.
Okay. Somebody tell me about the first soil. What does Jesus explain about the first soil? Pat?
That the hearer doesn't understand it.
Okay, he hears it. Mm-hmm. He does not understand it.
So it's lost. The devil snatches it away.
Evil one snatches away what was sown in his heart. Okay? The second soil. Somebody describe that to me. Teresa, would you attempt to do that, please?
Let's see. He hears it and receives it. But it seems like
it's not a good foundation. No firm root. So it's only temporary. So
when trials come, it falls away.
Okay. He hears it too. Correct? Okay. So let me describe the third soil. Keith?
They heard the word. But the cares and the deceitfulness of riches, the cares and the worries of the world choked it, and it became unfruitful, and so it strangulated it. They didn't bear any fruit.
Okay. And the fourth soil. Somebody describe that. Ron?
It was the seed that was sown on good ground, and it became fruitful.
Okay. Did the third soil here? Did the fourth soil here?
Mm-hmm.
What distinguished the fourth soil from the other three? Keith?
The condition of the heart.
Be more specific.
It was sown on good ground.
It was sown on good ground, yes. What is, Tim?
He understands it.
He understands it. Did any of the others of them understand it? Therefore, the stupid people will not go to heaven, not be saved, and only the intelligent will. Because only those who understand the seed are good soil. Is that true? Greg?
I see something what you were saying last Sunday morning. The first three had an agenda when they heard. They were looking for something.
Perhaps. Okay.
And one thought he found it and leaped around for joy.
Okay.
Found the happiness.
Teresa, what do you see?
Well, I see in verse 19 that when he hears the word, he does not understand it. It seems like it's just deceiving, and he will not understand it.
Seems like it should say that?
Yeah.
Okay. So, it says he does not understand it. Teresa said maybe he should say he will not understand it. Fourth one says he does understand it, and that's the one that's the good soil. It's the only one that's good soil. Keith, what do you see?
Well, I guess like you've been saying, if he understood it because the soil was good, so he had knowledge, then because the condition was right, so he was not willing to do God's will, and therefore he understood.
Now, are you saying that he understood because it was good soil, or his understanding is what is good soil?
Because he had good soil, he
understood. Really? Then what makes it good soil? Teresa, what do you think?
The willingness to understand.
The willingness to understand is what is good soil? Is that what you're saying? Now, where do you get that? Keith, what do you see?
That he received the seed, but that kind of forgot about all of them.
Yeah, they all received it. They all heard it. Teresa, what do you see? Jesus explains exactly what he means by good soil. Therefore, verse 13, therefore I speak to them in parables, because while seeing, they do not see, and while hearing, they do not hear, nor do they understand. Now why? Verse 14. And in their case, the prophecy of Isaiah is being fulfilled, which says, you will keep on hearing, but you will not understand, and you will keep on seeing, but you will not perceive. Why? For the heart of this people has become dull, and with their ears they scarcely hear, and they have closed their eyes, lest they should see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and return. And I should heal them. They do not understand because they have closed their eyes, lest they should hear with their ears, and understand. Their understanding is willful because they have closed that which is necessary to use to see, to hear, and would thereby understand. They have shut off the means of understanding, and that is why the word does not take root. That is why it is not good soil. It is a voluntary ignorance. There's no understanding because it's voluntary. It has nothing to do with intelligence, level, ability. It is an unwillingness to see the truth. It is an unwillingness to hear the truth. Therefore, the seed can do no good. It can produce no fruit. What is necessary in order to produce fruit? A willingness to see the truth, a willingness to hear the truth. The character issue again. People are spiritually deaf, dumb, and blind because of their character. They refuse to hear the truth, to see the truth. Unfruitfulness and spiritual ignorance is a result of willful ignorance. That's why I keep repeating that the people that you talk to and the variety of things that they throw to you are all smoke screens to keep from hearing, to keep from seeing, because of the consequences that they should be willing to hear and willing to see. So they say, prove to me that this is from God. To throw you off the track. Because whether this is from God or not is not the issue. The issue is that would they be willing to do that which they know they ought to do? All the smoke screen. How many angels can dance on the head of a pin? They used to argue that in the Middle Ages. How many angels can dance on the head of a pin? Can a Christian go to the movies and still go to heaven? Smoke screens. Those are not questions intended to do anything with the answer. They do not really want to know if that is true or not, because if you said no, they won't accept it. And if you said yes, they wouldn't believe it. Because it's a smoke screen. Now, I want you to think with me as I go across something, go through something. I know that many of you ask me questions when we have discussions that are serious questions upon your mind, and you really are looking for an answer for to settle something within you. I know that. I recognize that. And it is an earnest seeking of the truth, and I recognize that. What I'm going to describe has nothing to do with that. But I'm going to describe something that's very limiting in regards to your progress and understanding. And that is this. In times of discussion with people regarding spiritual truths, instead of thinking with me, I'm sure this happens to you when you talk to people, instead of thinking with me and trying to follow my thinking and let me lay out before you a truth. Your mind isn't thinking with me sometimes. Your mind is hoping that I'll get done with my boring layout of an idea so you can ask me a specific question about something you have in mind that you want to know about, and you're just patient enough to let me finish my construction of a model for you to draw truth from so you can hone in on your specific question, and you just ignore the broad thing that I lay out for you. Anybody know what I'm talking about? Anybody do that to you? Let me not use you. Let me just say some people do that. The truth is such that it's a picture. When you understand the picture, you yourself could pick out the answer if you saw the picture. But if you won't wait to see the picture, then you'll never see the picture. If you won't wait until, if you won't wait to look at the picture, but you just wait long enough so that when I finish talking, you can ask your specific, then you'll never see the picture and you'll never grow. You always depend upon Dennis to answer your specific rather than gain a concept of the general so you can draw your own implications and conclusions from. I gave Pat an illustration the other night that came to my mind and thought it was a good illustration. If I were to tell you, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go to Palm Springs. I want you to go to South Palm Canyon Boulevard. I want you to go to 1325 South Palm Canyon Boulevard, Suite 202. I want you to drop off a letter, and I want you to leave town. You come back, and I'd say, what do you think of Palm Springs? It was warm. Well, what did you think of the city? It was clean. Well, what, you like the city? Well, I didn't see the city. I got into the city limits, and I found Palm Canyon Drive, and I went to that 100 block you told me, and I found the building, and I went up to the suite and dropped off the letter and left town. Well, how come you didn't see the city? Because I was looking for 1300 South Palm Canyon Drive, Suite 202. I wasn't looking to see the city. So under those conditions, you could have found the exact address I told you to and did exactly what I told you to, but you would never have a view of the city. And multiply it by San Francisco or Denver or somewhere, enormous city. Some people go to Denver, and they spend some time there, and they get a sense of the feel of the city. There's a crazy street, Colfax. It goes like this in Denver. It's the only town I ever got lost in. Because you could be going on Colfax South, and pretty soon you're going on Colfax North or something like that. It's just incredible. I never knew where I was in Denver. I was always on the, I knew Colfax, but I never knew which direction I was going. If you go to Denver and you get the sense of the city and you get the sense of this layout and you get a sense of the tempo of the city and activities of the city, you can leave and you go, yeah, I've been to Denver. I know what it's like there. Think you'd like to live there? No, I wouldn't like to live there. It's too congested. It's kind of dirty. This or that. And you can describe it. But if I say go to Denver and go to a specific place and a specific address and drop off something and leave town and you did just that, you wouldn't know anything about Denver. You have a very narrow experience zeroing in on one thing. And as I was describing on Sunday, how to miss the truth is have your own agenda of a specific matter that you're looking to answer. And you come to me or you go to a Finney book or you go to the Bible looking for a specific answer without gaining the knowledge of the truth that that answer comes from, and you'll greatly diminish your growth and understanding. I think prayer is one of those subjects where this would be very important, because prayer is a subject that has underlying it great truths about God's character, about promises and their nature and their conditions and all that it implies. And if you were just to hone in and say, can I pray for a raise and it be the will of God? You can't answer that question. That question has answers or is answered in a context of a larger understanding of the truth of that. You can't answer questions about the love of God in Christ Jesus without being rooted and grounded in love. When I made those few comments on Sunday, I was getting at what I think most of you perceive quite quickly, and that is when you have an agenda for a certain bit of knowledge, you will miss everything else that's being said until, bingo, you hit it. And you might walk away satisfied that you got your answer to your agenda, but you'll remain just paralyzed in your development, in your growth and understanding. And I'm building these verses and these truths tonight in partly in addressing that matter so that you will see that you don't build a knowledge of God by addressing specific points. The true knowledge of God comes from, first of all, the state of your character before God. Your own personal holiness, out of which flows a true knowledge of God, a knowledge of the love of Christ after having been rooted and grounded in love. So when people ask me questions, and this is not a rebuke at all, when people ask me questions and I go off on my tirades about laying out for you, you know, okay, you have this question? Okay, we understand that the law commands this, and I start to describe this great truth to your mind. I'm not thinking about anybody in particular here, I'm just saying, I've done this so many times, it's just everybody I know has done this some time or another, so everybody's included, nobody's included, okay? Now, lay out this great foundational truth. It seems like the person patiently waits and say, yeah, but what about, and they just won't sit there and look at that truth and at least tell me, I don't understand that. Will you explain it to me so that I can see how that answers my question? Fair enough. Then it's back upon me to explain sufficiently clear that the answer can be drawn out by your mind or my mind or any mind as looking for the truth on that. And if I cannot, in my answer, make it clear enough that you can see the answer, or that we both together in looking at what I described to you can begin to pull it out, then I have failed in giving you an answer. So you need to say, Dennis, I can't see the answer in that. Now, have the humility to say, Dennis, I can't see the answer in that, because it doesn't mean your intelligence is failing. It may mean I'm not doing it well enough so you can see the answer. But the answer lies in seeing the picture and the application of the truth to your question in mind, and not just trying to tell you a specific answer. Because your growth of knowledge is going to depend upon you seeing the truth for yourself. And then each time a question or an issue comes up that it regards this truth, you can go to the model and see an answer or know where the answer lies. So the model I'm using tonight is, there is a class of truth that none of us will ever know, do not know until we are rooted and grounded in love, till this character is in us and growing in us, as Peter says, until we are willing to do His will, we will not know that the teaching is in fact from God. We will not know it. Now, that raises a very good question, a necessary question. What, it doesn't a person have to know something before they even become a believer? If you can't have a true knowledge of God without being benevolent, then how in the world do you ever become benevolent without a true knowledge of God, so to speak? What class of knowledge does every sinner know? What class of knowledge is every sinner in possession of already? Huh?
Moral law.
The moral law. Moral law. Every sinner already knows he ought to do good to his neighbor and not harm. Every sinner already knows and has a sense that some things are right and some things are wrong, because some things are not benevolent and some things are in fact selfish. Doesn't have to have a knowledge of the true knowledge of God. He doesn't have to have a knowledge of the love of Christ that passes understanding. Have a knowledge of something he's obligated to do that he is in rebellion against. True? Paul taught that in Romans chapter 1 and Romans chapter 2, did he not? He told me that. Through some agent, through some book. So that what his own conscience affirms and condemns him for is enlarged upon his mind, his attention is drawn to that until he begins to feel his guilt, and then he's an awakened sinner. Remember? Until he feels his guilt, then he's awakened. Then spiritual things can start to begin. But you cannot take the sinner and start beginning to tell him about the love of God, true knowledge of God, the love of Christ that passes understanding. Nobody can understand that unless they're rooted and grounded in love. That class of truths is not available to those except those who are willing to hear and to see. The soil that is willing to hear and to see is the soil that understands and brings forth fruit. The sinner must have presented to him those class of truths that bring him to a willingness to see and a willingness to hear. And the first class of truth that the sinner must know is what he already knows. The law, the moral law. Now, if that's true, then would it be wise to talk to a sinner about anything other than the law until he's awakened and convicted? Think with me. Y'all concur on that? Is there any reason to tell a sinner anything except the moral law and its various aspects until he is awakened and convicted? Well, because he has not, in his state, the ability to see those truths. In his state. Because he has blinded himself, he has deceived himself, he will not listen, he will not hear. Therefore, he is the kind of soil that the seed will just be taken away. Until he becomes willing. The only way for him to become willing is the first is for him to see he is not willing. And the moral law does that. You can eliminate a lot of frustrations in talking with sinners if you recognize that they already know a truth that needs to be reinforced to them, and that is the first truth that will do them good, and they cannot understand other truths until the law has done its work. And then you bring in the gospel and those classes of truth. Understand, impress upon you with a great hot iron, if a person you're talking to is not converted, then they will not be able to perceive a class of truths that are reserved for those who are. To present those truths to an unconverted mind is to get nowhere, and you probably have all had enough experience with that, of getting nowhere, because you're presenting a class of truths to a mind. Until they are led to repentance, they will not be led to a true knowledge of God. Ron, would you just share a few moments what I've asked you to share? I asked you a week ago, and then I delayed it for a week, about frustrations of trying to talk with sinful minds, and just some of that.
I was always under the impression being trying to find out Mormon philosophy and theology, and that was my mindset. I wanted to witness the cultists. So I just thought I should just witness truth. Theology, get them to believe theology, and somehow it will change. So when I received truth, I started understanding what real truth is, not just theology. I begin to see that my whole outlook on witnessing will change. And it won't be theology, but it will be the law. The problem is, I begin to beat people over the head with that. I'm not understanding their mind. Trying to sow the seed on rocky ground. And I was seeing closed doors and with family and close friends that I had. And I continued, I guess, in a way, to share theology, trying to get them to see if my understanding of Romans 3, 5, and 7, I'm getting to see the truth. I'm talking in circles. I wasn't really prepared to articulate.
I understand.
But a lot of failure, and I'm right now reaping the consequences.
He shared with me, I did not intend to put you on the spot. And thank you for sharing that. I think others have expressed similar, is that when you start talking about the law, they start to get uneasy. And you start to get uneasy. Huh? Because you see their uneasiness. And you want to just kind of back off so they don't squirm so much. It's kind of reciprocal. The more that they begin to squirm, the pressure that starts to build upon yourself for various reasons. And the temptation to let him off the hook without letting the pressure of the law, as Finney talked about and Paris Reed had reminded of us, talked about, remember the grinding stones, the millstone? Take a big grinding stone shape like this, and you put the seed in it, the wheat in it, whatever. You take the millstone that's shaped the same way, it sits on top, and you set it down there, and then you turn it. And the pressure of the top millstone against the large stone underneath grinds the wheat. And the big stone underneath is the law written on the heart, mind. And the millstone that grinds it is the moral law spoken to the person. And the moral law against the conscience begins to grind upon the mind of the sinner. And his guilt makes it greatly manifest. The pressure just builds up. But the sinner does not need at that time somebody let him off the hook. Especially the agent who's bringing the millstone to bear. And there's one of the challenges of talking to sinners. Is sympathizing with the sinner instead of sympathizing with the law. Right, Paul? Here's one of the challenges of not letting your sensibilities begin to sympathize with the sinner as the law does its remarkable, beautiful work, and then just insert something. It just relieves all that pressure. And the moment is past. Those precious moments when the pressure of the law is built upon the sinner's mind. Priceless moments. You can't recreate them. You can't recreate them at will. Your time and your speaking with them and their state of heart is such that you've caught them at a time when they're willing to think about these things. You've caught them at a time when they're willing to listen to you favorably. And the law comes in and starts to do its work. And the pressure builds up. And you sense that pressure yourself. That's not the time to let them off the hook. Because you can't recreate those times at will. There may be another time when all those things come together for the law to have its effect upon a person's mind.
Yeah. I never knew where to go.
In Matthew chapter 21, beginning with verse 23, I'll read and follow. And when he had come into the temple, the chief priests, Matthew 21:23, and when he had come into the temple, the chief priests and the elders of the people came to him as he was teaching and said, "By what authority are you doing these things? And who gave you this authority?" And Jesus answered and said to them, "I will ask you one thing too, which if you tell me, I will also tell you by what authority I do these things. The baptism of John was from what source, from heaven or from men?" And they began reasoning among themselves, saying, "If we say from heaven, he will say to us, then why did you not believe him? But if we say from men, we fear the multitude, for they all hold John to be a prophet." And answering Jesus, they said, "We do not know." He also said to them, "Neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things." Now, isn't that interesting? "By what authority do you do this? Tell me," Jesus said. "John, was he from heaven or from men?" Don't hear them. You don't hear what they think. The Bible records what they were thinking, but you don't hear anything until they say, "We don't know." The reason they said "we don't know" is if they said from heaven, they're trapped. And if they say from men, they're trapped. So the only answer is, "We don't know." And when you're talking with a sinner, And you're talking about the law and what it requires. I guarantee you they are way ahead of you. And they see the law coming down the path of their heart towards their conscience. And they know that when they start to agree with the law and what you're saying about the law, what it demands, they can see the tight squeeze that they're going to be in, the impossible situation they're going to be in if they agree with what they already know to be true. And all you hear out of their mouth is, I don't know. They know. They know they are caught between a situation in which either way they go, they are condemned. And all they say to you is, I don't know. But they know. This is such a beautiful picture of how the mind of man works and what it does, especially when faced with the truth and the consequences of the truth. And I don't know. Does that mean you can go around to everybody who says to you, I don't know, and say, oh, yes, you do, and tell them what they're thinking? No. But understand. Because I have seen it as just as if it was written on a piece of paper when I'm talking to somebody, and they agree with me, and they agree with me in the abstract until it starts to get personal to them, and all of a sudden you can hear them start to defending themselves or deflecting the issue or throwing up smoke screens. Well, what about this? What about that? Trying to get you to start thinking in some other direction than they are obligated to love God with all their heart and to love their neighbor as themselves. Do you love God? I heard a student the other day at the university say to a preacher on campus, do you love God? Don't you have a God of love? Now why do you talk to people like you do? That's a diversion. The diversion from the obligation for that they must love God and love their neighbor as themselves to a different issue. Smoke screens. And I get them all the time. It is pitiful to see a sinner squirm under the law at times because he has no way out. He really has no way out. Not under the law. There is no hope in the sinner, and the law begins to do its work. It begins to grind upon him in his conscience. The sinner, when he starts to see it all coming down upon him, sees he has no hope. And it's like you nail a fish that's just been caught to the ground and it just flails the mind of the sinner under the law because it has no hope. Death is coming. Struggling with a mind that is seeing death coming and struggling with every ounce to avoid it. Sadducees, by the way, were a small sect or group of Jews. It was the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The Pharisees were the largest number. The Sadducees were the very small number. But strangely enough, the Sadducees were the wealthy ones. And the Sadducees controlled who was the high priest. The high priest, when he was appointed, a new high priest was appointed, always out of the Sadducees, and usually in the same family to pass down. The Sadducees controlled the temple. But the Sadducees were a group of Jews who did not believe there was such a thing as a resurrection or angels or spirit. In Matthew 22, starting with verse 23, On that day, some Sadducees who say there is no resurrection came to him and questioned him, saying, Teacher, Moses said, if a man dies having no children, his brother as next of kin shall marry his wife and raise up an offspring to his brother. Now there were seven brothers with us, and the first married and died, and having no offspring left his wife to his brother. So also the second and the third down to the seventh. And last of all, the woman died. In the resurrection, therefore, whose wife of the seven shall she be? For they all had her. It was a Jewish practice that if a man married a woman and then he died and left no children, that his brother would marry her and bring up children, and they would be considered his offspring, the man who died's offspring, so that he would have offspring throughout the nation of Israel and not be left without children. Very important. So the Sadducees come to Jesus and said, here's a family of seven men, seven brothers, and the first one marries a wife and he dies, and the second one marries her to raise up children and he dies without children, and on through the seventh, and they all marry her to have children, and none of them are successful in doing so. Now Jesus, whose wife is she in the resurrection? First one, second one, third one, fourth one, fifth one, sixth one, seventh one. Come on, Jesus. Whose wife is she in the resurrection? We want to know. So, should Jesus start thinking, okay, I've got to answer this question, who it is in the resurrection? But do you see that's from a dishonest mind? Do you see that that question is a dishonest question from a dishonest mind? Because they already were prejudiced about the issue of resurrection. They did not believe there is a resurrection, as it says in verse 23. It is a dishonest question by somebody who has already made up their mind about an issue, only is seeking to trap the person, Jesus, that they are asking. Thinking that they have concocted a question that would destroy the idea of resurrection to this new rabbi who claimed that it is a resurrection, and they think they've concocted a question whereby they could stump him, and then therefore they could say, see, he has a belief in something that he can't answer the implications of our question. Which Jesus, of course, does have an answer for. But the point is, they did not have an honest question. They had an agenda. Because they were predisposed to a belief already. When you have an agenda, when you already are predisposed to believe something, your questions will be slanted not to get the truth, but will have some other purpose behind it. That is why I said on Sunday, you will miss the truth if you do not prepare your hearts to hear the truth, but go looking for something. So the sinner is looking for something. He is not prepared to hear the truth. He doesn't have eyes that are willing to see, ears that are willing to hear, a heart that's willing to understand. If he did, he wouldn't be a sinner anymore. He'd be good soil. So, I say this not to just about sinners, I say this to all of us. Prepare your hearts when you read Finney, when you read the Bible, when you contemplate the truth, when you hear me teach or preach, contemplate and prepare your heart at all times as you contemplate the Lord or seek His face to see the truth. Not have an agenda, because you'll distort everything that you hear. You'll only see the address that you're looking for. You will never see the landscape. Very important. Now, if a willingness to do His will is the condition for knowing that the teaching is from God, then I'd like to give you some of the implications of a willingness to do His will. A willingness to do His will implies that we have confidence in His character. If we have a willingness to do His will, His is mentioned here, there's a person, God. A willingness to do His will implies a confidence in His character. No moral agent has a right to be willing to do the will of another unless he has reasons to confide in the perfection of the will of another. No moral agent has the right to be willing to do the will of another unless he had reason to confide in the perfection of the will of another. Why would that be true? Because unless the will of another is totally conformed to the moral law, and you obey the will of another that is not conformed to the moral law, his will, you would sin. And unless you had confidence that the will of God is perfect, in perfect conformity to the moral law, and you obeyed his will, that is the only reason to have confidence and to obey his will, because you have confidence that he is in alignment with the moral law. Only right you have to obey the will of God is when you have confidence that his will is perfectly in conformity to the moral law. Otherwise, you would be willing to sin. Do you see that? If you would be willing to obey the will of God without a confidence that his will is in perfect harmony with the moral law, you would have a heart that is willing to sin. Until you have a confidence that his will is absolutely benevolent. So it's an implication that is, you have confidence in him. Implication is that you have supreme love to him. Implication is that you have a supreme regard for his authority. And you have a willingness to do his will. You have a willingness to have your life line up with righteousness on all accounts. You have a willingness to do all and your utmost for his glory. When you're willing to do his will, you have a willingness to make every sacrifice rather than displease him. When you have a willingness to do his will, you have a disposition to know the truth on all subjects. When you have a willingness to do his will, you have a disposition to know the truth on all subjects. You have no passion or idol to defend when you're willing to do his will. You have no selfish interest to promote. You have no appetite or passion to consult or defend. You consider our whole being as God's. You have no reputation of our own to maintain or defend. We no longer indulge our prejudices that blind our minds or harden our hearts. That goes along with the disposition to know the truth in all subjects. Prejudice is the passing of a judgment upon a subject, making a commitment to a particular side or view of a subject without seeing all of the evidence and considering all the sides of it. Deciding beforehand your disposition towards an issue, that's prejudice. That is contrary to a disposition to know the truth on all subjects. So no prejudices blind the mind of one who is willing to do his will. One who is willing to do his will is willing to set all aside prejudgment about people and ideas and concepts and set themselves to only live according to what evidence demonstrates is the truth, not what one prejudges without evidence, without reason. And a willingness to do his will is accompanied with the utmost gratitude to anyone who will point out anything in which we can, in any respect, be more perfectly conformed to the will of God. I find truthfulness, which is an attribute of benevolence, a beautiful consideration to look at. Truthfulness is an attribute of benevolence. The truth. If truth is an attribute of benevolence, then a benevolent person never makes a judgment unless it's based upon the truth. A benevolent person never speaks unless it's the truth. That's why they can be trusted. They refrain themselves from speaking unless they know the truth on the subject. They do not answer people's questions unless they have reasons to believe that their answer is based upon the truth. They realize that if they're going to do good to others, they must speak in truth. And hence, once again, the necessity, if you're going to do good to the sinner, the first truth they must hear is the law and all of its manifestations and all of its implications. And the law is more than just a 5-minute description that you must love God with all your heart, you must love your neighbor as yourself, and you can, and you must, and if you don't, there's penalties, and that's why God is righteous, because He punishes the sinner. The law of God is so much broader than that in all of its implications. I can spend hours with a new person. Hours. And never get off the law. It is so broad. It is so beautiful. It is so compelling upon the other person's mind. It is so enlightening to the soul. It's the very thing that takes a darkened soul that is complaining of their misery, and somebody says to talk to Dennis, and they're finally willing to talk to Dennis, and they start talking to them, and the law begins to break down their deceptions and gives them a light. It gives them a mirror to look at. It is truth. It is honesty. Total. And their mind confirms it's the truth. And after a while, they are on the side of the law instead of opposed to it, because it grabs the conscience of the person and obtains the conscience in agreement with the law, whether the will is in agreement or not. And pretty soon the conscience is on the side of the law, and the conscience is on the side of myself and talking to them. And the only thing opposed to me and what I'm saying is not their conscience and not their reason, but their will. So I'm trying to impress upon you tonight to understand the selfish, sinful mind will throw you all kinds of smoke screens, will ask you questions of no significance that matter, or will change their heart. And you must stay with the first trust of truth that they can understand, and that is the moral law, until they become awakened and convicted. And learn to broaden it in your understanding through your obedience in it. Through living with a totally benevolent heart, you will develop the ramifications in your own understanding of how that applies and all of its relationships to one another and to husbands and wives and to children and to God. And you can draw from that very knowledge that comes from living according to God's will. You can impose it upon others as to what it means to live according to His will, what it means to live in benevolence towards God. So if truthfulness is a manifestation of benevolence, then the truthfulness to the sinner is not to answer his questions, not to debate about theologies, but to take the law and let the law prepare him for grace. And I say to you, there's a class of truths that the sinner cannot understand until his character changes. And if you take those truths and try to impress upon the sinner, you'll be speaking in an unknown tongue, so to speak. He cannot comprehend the things while he's in a state of living according to his flesh, which is enmity against God. He cannot comprehend the beauties of the character of God, the true knowledge of God, the love of Christ that one understands in being rooted and grounded in love. Not until his heart has been changed. So understand that distinction. And understand for yourself that your knowledge of God and your desire to be filled with righteousness, hungry and thirsting after righteousness, you will be filled. But it will be conditioned upon your willingness to do His will. It's conditioned upon you and me being rooted and grounded in love. That's not the result of having knowledge. It is the condition of having a knowledge of Christ. It is a condition of knowing the height and depth and breadth and length. An excess of knowledge of the height and depth and length and breadth is not what leads to being rooted and grounded in love. It's just the other way around. So understand the difference, and understand for your own understanding, it is not knowledge that will lead you to holiness, holiness that leads you to the knowledge of the intimacy of the love of Christ. But to the sinner, it is the knowledge of the law and then the truth of the gospel that brings one to a change of heart and therefore prepares him to see the blessedness and the glories of the risen Christ and the inheritance in the saints and all the offices of that Christ is that we read about in the principles of union with Christ. Those are seen by the eyes of faith. Those are seen through the eyes of love. And enlighten further one who already is rooted and grounded in love. But you can't take principles of union with Christ to one who is not awakened and awaken them. There, that is food for the heart that is already alive. It's the law. One final statement. I alarm you. I alert you. When you're talking with people, they will try to turn you every which way but straight. When you start talking, their obligation to love God. Secondly, you will do the sinner no good unless your intent is to produce in them holiness. If your intent is to answer their theology, if your intent is to destroy false theology, you will not do them any good. If you do not see all that you do and are not laboring to bring about holiness in them, and if you see it necessary as a means to deal with theological question, but your intent still is to bring about holiness, then you can succeed. Because your intent to bring about holiness will constrain you from simply talking theology for its own sake. And you will... is necessary. And holiness in them, as it is in us, is necessary for us to be in a state of blessedness and to truly know God. Then take 5 minutes more if necessary to see if you have some questions about what I'm talking about. Do you see what I'm talking about? Do you see what I'm talking about? This is not intended to diminish your questions. It is to direct them to be more fruitful. Most fruitful. It is to let you know that I am always available to talk with anybody who does not see truth as applied to a particular case. But let us think together to understand the truth and draw out of it your answer than to just have an agenda of a specific thing we're looking for. Because that doesn't enable me to do good to you, and it will paralyze you from really developing your understanding of the truth. Does anybody have a question? I will stop talking for 2 minutes.